Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri, and the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour, please visit the webpage georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on contracts. Where is it in the law? When we come back. You know, the lessons on courtroom strategy and procedure that you hear on this program are just a small part of my 2-week basic courtroom strategy and procedure school, and this class includes lessons on what to do and what not to do at the scene of the alleged crime, and what you should say to the police or investigators, and what you ought not to say to the police. And you'll learn how to conduct yourself in your case at bail setting, arraignment, pleadings, motion hearings, trial, and appeal. And you'll learn how to ask questions, cross-examine adverse witnesses, select a jury, introduce exhibits and evidence, and conduct discovery, do legal research, and follow the rules of court. In total, there are 28 elements to learn in courtroom strategy and procedure, and one rule is that all of the evidence that your opponent is ever going to use against you is going to be furnished by you. So keep your mouth shut, don't say anything, and shut up. That's called Rule 1, and after Rule 1's out of the way, we can get to the real business of winning your case. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call the law school? The number's 417-273-4967. And be sure to ask for the free general law CD package. That's the place to start. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining. It's educational. It's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. That number again, 417-273-4967. Remember, courtroom strategy and procedure is also available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, you can go to the website georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Click on the email and send an email request for your free general law CD package, georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, last time we were talking about contracts. Where is it in the law? Derived from a question sent in by a listener who asked the question. He said, you keep saying that these licenses like social security, driver's license, marriage license, business license are contracts. Can you show me that in the law? Can you show me any law, case, record, statute, and so on, code? And that's what we've been covering here for the last few programs. Examples of here's where it is in the law. Now, I'm going to give you another example here today from experience. You can experience the contractual nature of the law by making an observation. Sometimes it isn't written in the law, and this listener is looking for a place in the code that says Social Security is a contract, and he wants that written in the law by President Franklin D. Roosevelt. Well, Roosevelt didn't write in there that Social Security is a contract, but the courts have told us that. And the observations that we've made tell us that. Kessler on contracts tell us that. Bouvier's Law Dictionary on contracts, it's an offer with an acceptance over time with consideration, tell us that. So, you know, oftentimes, in spite of what somebody tells you, there are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. There are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. There are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Well, you know, then over time, our observation tells us, well, no, there aren't any weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And so pretty soon our observation says, well, in spite of what the government tells us, there aren't any. So just because the government tells you something doesn't necessarily make it true. I mentioned that also, you know, just because I say it doesn't make it true. So the burden of proof is on me, and I said, okay, well, let me take up the burden of proof, and let me show you my evidence, and we'll go from there. So I'm going to tell you a couple of stories. An old buddy of mine, his name is Pat Connolly. An old Pat, his hot button in life was zoning and planning. And he did a lot of research into zoning and planning, and building permits and one thing and another. And old Pat had a house and 7 acres on Eustick Road up in Boise, Idaho. It was back in the 70s. Could have been back in the 60s. I kind of forget now. Now it was in the 70s, late 70s. And he'd been out there. This piece of ground that he was on, this house in 7 acres, was the old farmhouse on an old farm out there. Been there for many years. And it had been sold off for subdivisions and housing. And over the years, the subdivisions kept getting bigger and bigger and closer. And pretty soon, Pat Connolly gets totally surrounded by these housing developments. Well, that made his property pretty valuable. So they came up to him one day, some developer did, and said, "Hey, Pat, that house you got there is worth nothing, but the land is worth something. And we want to buy that land and subdivide it and build houses on it." And they offered him $10,000 an acre for the 7 acres, $70,000. Well, my God, $10,000 an acre in those days, you know, was just out in space, you know, it was out in the stars. And so old Pat said, "Well, it's an offer I can't refuse. I'm going to sell." And so they went to the closing to sell come to find out some years before that, because of all of the building that had been going on out there, they put in what's known as a LID, an LID, a limited improvement district. It's a little political subdivision. And they put sewers and water out here on Eustick Road, you know, out 10, 15 miles from Boise or something like that. Well, when they put that out there, they had an election. And, of course, Pat Connolly voted against this LID, and, of course, everybody else out there voted for it, and so they put it in. One day they sent Pat a letter, and they said, "Well, you've got to hook up to the sewer, and that's going to cost you $330 to hook up to the sewer." And so Pat wrote him a letter, and he said, "Well, I don't want to hook up to the sewer, and I'm perfectly satisfied doing what I've been doing here for the last 10 or 15 years, and so thanks, but no thanks." And so he didn't sign up. And so the LID put a lid against their, put a lien against this 7 acres. And so by the time old Pat goes to the closing, there's an $800 lien. See, he's supposed to be paying $5 a month or something, or 10, you know, for the water and sewer, and he hasn't been doing that, you know. And so they just put a lien against it. They figure, well, someday it'll sell, and when it does, when we go to the closing, well, we'll take it. Now, old Pat wrote him a letter, and he said, "Now, don't do this," but that had been several years before. So we go into the closing, and they announce to him that, well, with interest and penalties and taxes and so on, you owe $800. Well, you know, what's $800 out of $70,000, you know? So we get a check for $69,200. Well, old Pat squirreled the deal right there. He says, "No, the deal is $70,000, and you write the check for $70,000, and if I don't get paid $70,000, we ain't selling." So they squirreled the deal right there at the closing. So old Pat goes back home, and he wrote a letter to the LID, and he said, "Well, evidently you people want to take my property without just compensation." Now, I'm going to jot this word down. It's called property. Property is the greatest buzzword in judicial parlance, property. Because property is constitutional. Sewage is a hazardous waste. Now, you can't have sewage because that sewage, you see, threatens the health, safety, and welfare of your neighbors. It threatens the health, safety, and welfare of the community. It's like having nuclear waste. It's like putting, you know, a ton and a half of dynamite in your garage, you know, in your neighborhood. You know, it's just not done. We don't want that. Now, it doesn't mean that you can't have sewage. It just means you can't have sewage in close proximity to your neighbors. Now, 7 acres over here seems like to be enough proximity, but remember, they'd passed a law. They created a limited improvement district, and the law says that you got to join up with this limited improvement district, and old Pat didn't do it. And so, you know, most people look at that and say, "Well, that's the end of that argument." No, not quite. Property comes into play. So Pat went home, and he wrote a letter to the LID, and he said, "Now, I went to a closing. I was offered $70,000 for my property. And you people put a lien on my property. And because of your lien, it squirreled the deal and I lost $70,000. So I want you to pay me the $70,000. So he made demand for the $70,000. And he said, some years back, you came to me and said that you wanted to take my night soil, that you wanted me to hook up to the sewer, that you wanted to take my sewage. Well, I don't have any sewage. What I have is night soil that I store in a 1,000-gallon tank behind my house. And I use that night soil. It's property, and I use it for fertilizer, just like they do in China and Japan and other Oriental countries. And if you want to take my property, I'd like to sell it to you for $1.40 a gallon, and I can produce about 100 gallons a day. And I want a 30-year contract, and you guarantee to pay me $1.40 a gallon for my night soil, and I'll sell it to you. Otherwise, we've got a takings claim here, and we're going to go into an inverse condemnation of my property. Well, I got to thinking about that for a while. And we don't know what happened behind the scenes with the legal department of the Limited Improvement District. However, here's what the outcome was. The developer, who wanted to buy the property anyway, came to Pat and said, "You're going to get your whole $70,000 check, Pat." Now, whether the developer agreed to pay the $800 or whether the LID went to the developer and said, "Go give him a $70,000," I imagine at that point in time, Pat could have raised the ante to $80,000, and I just bet you they would have paid it. I bet you they would have paid it, because that word property is the magic buzzword, and night soil is the correct response to sewage. Because I don't have a hazardous waste, I have property, and you're trying to take my property without just compensation and violation of the Fifth Amendment. Anyway, they went to another closing. Pat got his $70,000. He didn't pay the $800. We don't know if it was paid or wasn't, whether the LID backed off, whether the developer paid it. I don't know. Can't tell you. But the old adage that says you can't beat City Hall isn't true. It isn't true. And then I'll show you another example. Now, we're talking about contract here. Contract. Now, you can have laws, and limited improvement districts can put liens on your property. But you know, there's a thing called rights, and where rights are involved, there can be no rulemaking or legislation which would abrogate them, so says the Supreme Court of the United States in Miranda versus Arizona. Where rights are concerned, there can be no rulemaking or legislation which would abrogate them. So your job is to show that you've got rights. And Congress comes along, and when they enact legislation, when your legislature or your city council comes along to enact legislation, they don't enact legislation based upon rights. They enact legislation based upon commerce. And commerce is predicated upon contract. Now, that contract may be an adhesion contract. It may be an implied contract. We went over that when I went through adhesion contracts. There's a number of these special types of contracts. And it may be one of those. And in most cases, it is. Very seldom does government come right out and say we've got a contract, although in the Bible, the common law that we call the common law today is derived from the Mosaic law. And there are 22 principles of that law contained in our federal constitution. And the law that God gave to Moses, who then in turn brought it down off the mountain, gave to the people, is predicated upon contract, and the word covenant is used in the Bible several hundred times. And God uses terms like, "You broke my covenant. And if you break my covenant, here's what I'm going to do unto you." And the Old Testament is a testament. It's a testimony. It's why it's called the Old Testament, the Old Testimony. Got the New Testament, the New Testimony. It's the new contract. It's the old contract. It's the covenant. And sin is the transgression of the law. Sin is a breach of contract. And in Exodus 24, verse 7 and 8, all that the Eternal has said, we will do and be obedient. It was the acceptance of the terms and conditions of the old covenant. All right. Now, we found out by adhesion contract that what we're dealing with adhesion contracts, is the Roman civil law contract. And there's only two forms of law, civil and common. Now, Pat Connolly comes over and he says, okay, well, now, the people of the community are trying to create an implied obligation, an implied contract, Since everybody, the majority, agreed to this limited improvement district and we want sewers and so on, that they can force me to participate in this contract. And I don't want to do that. I want to apply my rights. And Connolly succeeded. He wasn't a member of that limited improvement district. He voted against it. Everybody else voted for it. Now, the limited improvement district was there to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the public by disposing of that nasty sewage. Pat Connolly comes in and says, I don't have any sewage. I only have night soil. Night soil's property. I can take care of my property. I store it in a 1,000-gallon tank, and I use it to fertilize my fields, and you want to take it. And if you want to take it, you pay me $1.40 for it, or let's go litigate. They backed off and paid him. Now, Connolly wasn't through with that deal. He had a lot on Eustick after he sold that place. Well, now he needs a place to live. No, Pat's no. Poor guy. And he had a farm up in Emmett, a 235-acre place up there in Emmett, Idaho. And old Pat was interested in zoning and planning, and he wanted to build a house with no building permit. He wanted to build a house with no building permit. And we all looked at that and said, Pat, you're out of your mind. And here's the terror tactic the government uses. If you try to build a house without a permit, they're going to come after you, and they're going to prosecute you. They're going to get a judgment against you and make you tear that house down. So you got $20,000, $30,000, $50,000 invested in this house, and you got to bulldoze it down. Oh, that just scares the bejesus out of everybody. So everybody goes down and says, well, I don't want to take that risk, so I'll go down and get the building permit and build the house. Do you have to have a building permit to build a house? Well, if the house is engaged in commerce, you do. Because all legislation that comes out of your legislature, city council, and your governmental institutions is predicated upon the Commerce Clause. But what if it was based upon a constitutional right? Do you have a constitutional right to shelter? Do you have a constitutional right to pursuit of happiness? Do you have a constitutional right to property? I mean, those are just basic questions of law that have been asked and answered, you know, over the years. And the answer to all of those questions is yes, 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 you have those rights. Now, you can surrender your rights for a privilege. And remember that that's one of the drawbacks of these adhesion contracts is that government is offering you some kind of a benefit. Well, old Pat owned this lot free and clear, and I think he was paying $27 a year taxes on it, as I recall. And he wants to build a house. So he got all of the building materials together up there at his farm in Emmett. He got the windows and doors and all the lumber and cement and gravel and everything that he needed. He got it all there in a big pile in Emmett. Then he went down to zoning and planning. And Boise, in those days, you had to go down to zoning and planning. Now, he wasn't seeking a variance. He wasn't trying to build something that wasn't already approved for that area. It was a single-family residence on a single-family residence lot. So he goes into zoning and planning. And he says, I'd like to get a zoning and planning approval so that I can go over and get a building permit and build a house. So zoning and planning said to him, well, that's fine, but you got to submit to us an architect's drawing of the house that you propose to build there. Architect's drawing. So Pat goes over to a buddy of his, happens to be an architect, and he says, hey, Tom, I need a drawing. And Tom says, well, Pat, you need to pay me $5,000 for a drawing for a house to put on that lot. And Pat says, well, that's all well and good, but I'm poor, and I don't have $5,000. And because I'm poor and don't have $5,000, it's my contention that this whole process is a discriminatory process against the poor. If I had $5,000 and I could pay you $5,000, I could get the plans and I could go over and get them approved. They said that they would approve them as soon as I came in with architect's drawings. Notice that this is commerce. Architects are licensed. And we're going to pay the guy $5,000 to get the drawing. So this is a commercial venture. And zoning and planning and building departments are there right up to their eyeballs in commerce. And so the Supreme Court in 1964 said that no, vagrancy was a violation of fundamental rights, constitutional rights, in requiring people to have money. or you're going to put them in jail. Poor people have a right to live too. Poor people have a right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, and just because they don't have money doesn't mean we're going to throw you in jail. So Pat says, well, just because I don't have money is no reason to throw me in jail. Just because I don't have money is no reason to deny me a house, shelter. So he went into zoning and planning with a letter from the architect that said he wanted $5,000. And Pat said to the guy there in zoning and planning, he says, I don't have any money. And I want to build a house on my lot. I own the lot. It's free and clear. Taxes are paid. I want to build it. And I don't have $5,000 for an architect's drawing, but I do have this napkin. And this is what I want to build it on. Well, they took that back into their legal department, and they came to the conclusion, after Pat told them that he thought that they had a discriminatory policy, and they said, well, in your case, we're going to make a waiver here. We're going to waive the requirement for a drawing, and we're going to approve your house on that property, knowing full well that without the drawing, he couldn't get a building permit. So he goes over to the building department now with the approval from zoning and planning, who backed down, by the way. And the building department said, well, fill out this form. And on the form it says, well, how much is the estimated cost of this project? Now, normal people would write in, you know, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 or something back in those days, back in the 70s, you know, $40,000 to build you a big house. And old Pat, he gets down to that line and he wrote in $0. I'm going to build a house and I'm going to spend $0. Well, at that time in Boise, you couldn't get a building permit unless you were going to spend $100 or more. So if you were just going to do a $50 job or a $20 job or something like that, why, you didn't need a building permit. That's called a repair. But if you're going to build a house, that's a pretty substantial amount. And, of course, normal people that are going to build a house are going to buy lumber from Thriftway Lumber Company, and that's going to cost more than $100. And they're going to call the ready-mix company and the cement company and the plumbing company and electrical company, and all of that's going to cost more than $100. So they will write in a number. They'll say, well, $20,000 or $30,000 or $40,000, whatever the number is. And that's commercial. Comes under the Commerce Clause. They're going to spend Federal Reserve Note dollars. Pat wrote in zero. And, of course, they said, well, you can't build a house for no dollars. And Pat said, why? Is there a law against it? Now, think about this for a minute. People have been building houses in New Guinea, you know, and in the Philippines, and they're not spending any dollars on them, are they? If I could build a house for no dollars, do I have a right to do that? Now, people can live under bridges. And I brought that up last time. We were talking about a fella here that gave me wrote me a letter, and he said this is the problem that he's having. And he said, I'm living in my van. I'm 57 years old. And I'm a poor man, and I don't have enough money to build a house. I don't know why this guy's living in his van. What difference does it make to you or me or anybody else if this guy wants to live in his van? I don't want to live in a van. Do you? But what is it to us if this guy wants to live in a van? What if this guy wanted to live in a grass shack? And he wanted to build a sod house in the middle of Nebraska. What the hell do we care if this guy wants to live in a chicken coop or a sod house or a grass shack in Hawaii or live in his van? You ever stop and think about that? Why can't this guy live in his van if he wants to? You know, we Americans kind of have it in our minds that there are certain standards, you know, that we adhere to. And we want everybody else to adhere to those standards. And that's why we're over in Iraq. We have a political standard that we adhere to, and we want to enforce that political standard on the Iraqis. Yeah, I'm sitting over here saying, well, why do we even care whether those Iraqis live or die? What relevance does it have to us? You know, most of you people out there listening to me right now, 5 years ago couldn't have found Iraq on a map at high noon with both hands and directions. Hell, you didn't even know those people were there, much less care about them. And that's where I'm coming from. I'm simply sitting here saying, you know, here's Arcata, California, says, well, you can't live in your van. It violates the standards of decency in our community. Well, you got the same thing here with building permits. I mean, you know, most Americans like building permits. They like zoning and planning because it protects their property values. They don't, they'll tell you, I don't want somebody building a hog farm next to my residential house in Bel Air, California. As if somebody was going to come in here and put a hog farm in next to, or pay the kind of real estate prices in Bel Air to build a hog farm. I mean, come on guys, let's grow up and get real, you know? Zoning and planning is nothing more than a communist proposal under the first plank to the Communist Manifesto to abolish all right to private property. That's the purpose of it. That's what it accomplishes. It violates, it destroys your right to personal, private property. It's property ownership by committee. That's what it boils down to. Well, no, I'm not opposed to property ownership by community or committee. That's what Americans want. Americans like communism. Americans like the first, second, third, fourth, fifth planks. They like the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto and practice them all. Love it. And I'm sitting here saying, well, I don't think that we should get in the way of the happiness and success of multiple tens of millions of Americans who like communism and want to practice that. And so I'm just asking all of you communists out there, what about this guy that wants to live in his van? What's the bitch here? What do we care? He's not saying to you that you can't have zoning and planning. He's just saying, well, how come I can't live in my van? Well, the answer, I covered this last night. I said, the reason why is because you're in commerce. And because you're in commerce, you can be regulated and controlled. That's just where it's at. There's an old-timey case called Wolf Company versus Industrial Court that separates out private business from public business. This guy's got a van. I presume it's licensed. I presume he's a licensed driver. And because he's a licensed driver with a licensed van, he can be regulated and controlled. He doesn't have a property right in that van. He doesn't have a property right in that public park. That public park is owned by committee. That van is owned by the state. You're driving the state's van and you want to park it in the people's commune, the people's community park? I mean, come on, Bob, or whatever your name is here. Let me get your name down here. I think it's George, isn't it? Yeah, George. All right, George, now pay attention here because here's old Pat. You know, he's a poor guy. He didn't have any money. He's got all the building materials. Somebody said to me one time, well, how did he pay for all the building materials? Who in the hell told you that Pat Connolly paid for a single board that went into that house on Eustick Road? I told you he had a farm. It's 235 acres. He owned that free and clear. Pat never said that he paid a dollar for a single board that went into that building on Eustick Road. He put the building materials together. Maybe they were given to him by friends and relatives, and maybe he had a sawmill up there. Maybe he cut his own boards. Maybe he went down there and dug his own gravel out. Maybe he went out and mined his own cement. Maybe that's the way he got it all. His testimony in front of Judge Carey was that he had spent less than $100 building that house. I don't want to get ahead of myself here, but... So Pat, remember, now he's down at the building department, and they looked at his application and said, look, son, you can't get a building permit unless the project is in excess of $100. And Pat said, well, I don't want to spend any dollars at all. I don't want to spend $5, $10, $20, or $50. I'm not going to spend any money. I'm poor, I don't have any dollars, and I don't want to spend any dollars, but I want to have a house just like Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis. I mean, they have houses to live in. By God, I want one too. And I don't want you to discriminate against me because I'm poor and I don't have $5,000 for an architect's drawing. They accepted his napkin at the building department. They said, well, okay, we don't want to discriminate against you, but we're not going to issue you a building permit because you're not going to spend $100. Pat said, okay. So he went out and broke ground. So here's old Patty's out there just working away, having a good time. And power company came out and set a pole for him, and he's got electricity there now, and he's just out here doing his thing and having a great time. And one day, Ranger Rick comes by, and he sees Pat out there with his little, what was that little thing he had there, little bucket-loading black cat or something like that. I forgot now what they called those. And he's moving dirt and having a good time, and, you know, it's just like a kid playing in a sandbox. You know, the only difference between men and boys is the price of their toys. Remember that? And Ranger Rick comes in there and he says, wait a minute, you're building a house here, aren't you? Yeah, I'm building a house. And you don't have a building permit. Nope, I don't have a building permit. And he says, I'm going to red tag this job. And so the building inspector red tagged the job. Now, when you get a red tag on your job, that means cease and desist, or we'll send the sheriff out here and kill you if we have to. So he stopped, and he was called in before Judge Carey, and they had a little trial. Let's take our break right here, and let me give you a couple of messages, and we'll be back and tell you a little bit more here about the story of Pat Connolly and the Eustick House Road when we come back. In the meantime, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertiser, sponsors, management, or staff of the network, radio station, or anybody else. Just me. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and the editorial review, just go to the website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Click on to the email, send an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember that. You can just go to the website, georgegordon.org, and that'll tell you how to send an email to us. Or you can call us direct, 417-273-4967. Keep in mind now that the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, call the law school direct, 417-273-4967. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States, worldwide, over the internet. For more information about the law school and the Law Hour, just go to our website. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that's open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Talking about building permits right now. Got a letter here from a guy. We're talking primarily this week about contracts. Law is predicated upon contract. I got a specific letter here from a guy named George in Arcata, California. And old George wants to live in his van. Crazy. I know it. It's nuts. But I asked the question, I said, what the hell do we care? How does that affect my lifestyle or yours? Well, we're afraid, George, that you're going to park your van out in front of my house in Bellwood Estates and depress the property values by having a bum like you parking your van and living out in front of my house. And so I need laws that will protect me from people like you, George. Yeah, I gotta have laws. I gotta go to the city council and get them to pass an ordinance to prevent you from living in your van. To make you go out here and get a house and a mortgage and put yourself in debt like all the rest of us. We can't have free men running around out here debt-free, living in their vans, laughing at all of us that are paying interest and taxes and mortgage insurance and etc., living in all these houses out here, working like feudal serfs to support the bankers, the insurance industry, and the political establishment. We can't have free men like you running around, George. That's what the bottom line is. So we enact these laws to protect our property values. I mean, we're just real concerned about bums like you. So I told you last night, I said, well, look, you can go park in any truck stop. And then on top of that, you got restroom facilities there, and you got a restaurant there, and so on. I assume that you're not cooking too much in your van, but, you know, I don't know that. And then you can go out here and park along, you know, the major highways. You know, they have rest stops, and you can park there in a rest stop, you know, and just sleep. Nobody cares. Or you can just go out here on any state highway, like Highway 299, for instance, between, Arcata and Redding. There's lots of pull-offs on that highway there, George. And you can just pull off there and sleep anytime you want. I mean, I've done it many times, never had any problem. You're out in the county. See, you're not there in the city messing around in front of my house, depressing my property values. Or you can get off on a county road someplace, and just pull off on a wide spot someplace and sleep there. And then morning comes, you go out there and do whatever you do every day. So I told you how to solve that problem over there. But what we're dealing with here is contracts and commerce. And Pat Connolly now wants to test a very important law. A commercial law. A law that requires a building permit. Now also, you gotta have an electrical permit and a plumbing permit. So old Pat goes over to Dick Alloway at Alloway Electric, and he made a deal with Dick, and he said, well, put on the service, I'll wire the house. And he paid him $1, another good and valuable consideration. He went over to a plumbing company, Howard Vandy Grift Incorporated, and he had Howard hook up the house to the sewer. Howard pulled the permit. Now in those days, it cost $30 to pull a permit. Cost you $330 to hook up to the sewer. Howard did it for Pat for $1, another good and valuable consideration. Howard went out there, hooked up Pat's sewer, paid $30, got paid $1, lost $29 on the permit, and God knows how much on hooking it up. There's nothing in the law that requires that contractors make a profit. You ever wonder about that? Howard's a commercial man. Howard went down and got a permit, hooked him up to the sewer. Well, Pat went into the plumbing department and the electrical department also to get permits, and they said, well, if you're not going to spend $100, you can't get a permit. And so here's Pat. He doesn't have an electrical permit, a plumbing permit, or a building permit, and he's out here building a house. Ranger Rick comes over. This is the building inspector. Says, hey, I'm going to red tag your job. Hauled him in front of Judge Carey, and they had a trial. They litigated. I'm going to find out about this. And if they can prevail against Pat, they're going to make him bulldoze everything down that he's got and make him get a permit. So the question came up, and the government witnesses all came in and testified, this guy's building a house and he don't have a permit. Pat Connolly got on the witness stand and testified, yes, I'm building a house. So what? I went down to get a permit and they wouldn't give me one. On cross-examination, he examined, how come you wouldn't give me a permit? Well, because you put down zero, that you weren't going to spend any dollars. And Pat said, well, how many dollars have I spent so far? And all testified, we don't know. Pat got on the witness stand, testified, I haven't spent any dollars. Judge Carey looked at it, took it under advisement for 21 days, came back, gave a written opinion. And he said, well, until you spend $100, you don't need a permit. Did you get that, boys and girls? Until you spend $100, you don't have to get a permit. Pat Connolly has just as much right to build a house as anybody else. He just doesn't have a right to build a commercial house. That's all. And all you people are out there building commercial houses. Well, commercial houses are regulated under the Commerce Clause of Article 1, Section 8. Regulated and controlled. If you're going to build a commercial house and spend more than $100, and by God, get down there and get your permits, sit down, shut up, and fold your hands and do what you're told. Now, if you want to build a private house, that's another story. You got rights. Now, we talked about rights. Remember? Rights. Constitutional rights in Hale versus Henkel. Individuals have rights. Corporations don't. If you want to act like a corporation, we'll treat you like a corporation. Want to act like an incompetent, we'll treat you like an incompetent. So old Pat finishes the house. He doesn't spend any dollars. Now, God help old Pat now if Thriftway Lumber Company comes trundling up to the building site and offloads a unit of 2x4s now. You know what's going to happen? Well, then they're going to go down to Thriftway and say, well, how much money did you charge Connolly for that? They went down and asked Dick Alloway, I guess, how much money, and they had a contract written up for $1. Well, he still got $99 to go. They did that with Howard. They went down to Howard Vandegrift and said, hey, how much money is this contract for? He said, $1, another good and valuable consideration. Well, how much was the other good and valuable consideration worth? No dollars, but it was good and valuable, whatever it was. But it wasn't in dollars. Remember, this is commercial. So the judge says, well, I'm going to dismiss the case, and the case was dismissed. Conley goes back out and goes to work. Now, Conley was very conscientious man. And every time he had a rough in, every time he had an inspection point in the project over there, well, he called the building department. In fact, he sent him a certified letter, registered return receipt request. It took 10 days for every inspection. Now, normally, you know, us building guys, you know, we just call the inspector, you know, this afternoon at 2 o'clock and say, hey, listen, we'd like to have an inspection out here by noon tomorrow. And the inspector comes by, looks at your headers, and approves it, and away you go. So, now Pat doesn't have a permit, so he writes him a letter and he gives him 10 days. That's the legal requirement. Got to give him 10 days. And so every time Pat needs an inspection, a little less convenient, isn't it? 10 days goes by, they don't come out and inspect. Oh, Pat closes up the walls and goes about his business. Pretty soon he finishes the project. Howard hooked him up to the sewer, so he's got sewer. Howard hooked him up to the water. He's got water. Now, here's his problem. It was the electrical department that posed the problem, because when he called Idaho Power Company, he said, hey, come out here and hook up my power. Power Company comes out and says, well, where's the final inspection? And he doesn't have a final inspection, so the Power Company says, well, until we get a final inspection, we can't hook up the power. Now, that's an Achilles heel. Well, Pat was prepared for that. He'd wired that house up for a generator. He's going to hook a generator up to that. And so he got to thinking about that, and we went down to Barrister's Inn. We got to mulling that over in one of our think tanks, and we said, you know, it sounds like to me that if you don't need a permit to put that electrical in, then you don't need a final inspection to get it hooked up. Why don't you go to Terry Swisher down at the Public Utilities Commission? So they held a hearing down there, and they produced witnesses, evidence, and testimony. Went through the same thing with the PUC that they went through with Judge Carey, and the PUC came to this conclusion, that since he didn't need a permit to wire the place because he was spending less than $100, then he didn't need a final inspection to hook up the power, and they ordered the power company to hook it up, and they did. Now, here was an interesting thing that came up later. Because there's no building permit, there's no final inspection, so there's no certificate of occupancy. So as far as the city's concerned, that house doesn't exist. That's a vacant lot. And the taxes stay at vacant lot rates, $27 a year. In addition to that, there's no address. So you can't get an address issued by the city. And if you don't have an address, you can't get mail delivery. So Pat couldn't get mail delivery. Furthermore, when he wanted to move to Florida some years later and sell the house without a CO, certificate of occupancy, no bank will loan a quarter on it. So he had to sell it on a contract for deed. All right, so there's some drawbacks. And that's because the house isn't in commerce. The house is a dwelling. It's not a commercial instrument. Doesn't have an address, doesn't have a CO. See how that works, George? See how these contracts work? I mean, that's just the way life is. And so as I pointed out here, answering the question here for Raymond, you know, Raymond, he sends me a letter. He says, have you got any evidence of this? Yeah, Pat Connolly. Two of them. Two stories. From personal observation, that's what happens. Now let's take a look at another subject matter over here called license. Remember we were talking about licenses over here? Well, here's Bouvier's Law Dictionary. Let's just take a look here at some statements here concerning a license. In real property law, a license is permission. It's a right given by some competent authority to do an act which without such authority would be illegal, a tort, or a trespass. So a license, then, is permission to do something that's illegal, unlawful, a tort, or a trespass. Did you get that? So a license is permission to commit a crime. It's permission to break a law. It's permission to do something that would be a violation of the law if you didn't have this license. This is why medical doctors have to be licensed, because medical doctors are killers. They have to be licensed to kill people. And there's a statute in Exodus 15:26. God comes along and says, I am your healer. And the state comes along and says, no, that's a lie. God is not your healer. Marcus Welby, M.D., is your healer at Mercy Medical Center, the hospital down the street. And we're going to license both of these institutions. And they've sold it to the American people. In fact, they've sold it to most people around the world. Most people prefer medical services to divine healing. I mean, the average guy on the street doesn't want to pray to Jesus to heal him. He wants to go to a real doctor. He wants to get real medical services, and so they do. So the state comes in and licenses this medical doctor to violate Exodus 15, verse 26. That's the purpose for the license. There are 15 of these professions. I covered professions, actually. There's more than that. There's 15 basic professions. But now they've expanded that. There's a bunch of other professions out there that have just been created. They used to be common law occupations, but now they're professions. And by creating these professions, we can license them. And by licensing them, we can make money off of them because they're in commerce. Now, medical doctor has always been a crime. Lawyer has always been a criminal. All you lawyers out there, you're criminals. That's why you're licensed. The definition of a license is just that. I don't have any licenses, but I don't intend to break any laws, so why would I need a license? Well, there's some things that we want to do. Now, I've had people tell me, well, driving a car isn't a crime. Yeah, it is. Sure it is. Where are you driving your car? Well, I'm driving it on the public highway. Are you driving it on Highway 160? Yeah. Okay. Well, I happen to own the piece of road 660 feet long on Highway 160. Just wanted to let you people know that. And because I own that 660 feet, I pay the property taxes out to the center line of the road on both sides of the road, since the road runs through my place. And when you drive through there, you're trespassing on my property and you have to pay me. Oh, and you're going to say, well, I don't have to pay you. That's right. That's because the state came in here and condemned the right-of-way and took my property, but they still make me pay the property tax on it. So you have to have a license. And when you see a truck and it goes down the road and it says, this vehicle pays $5,230 a year in road use taxes. Well, by God, he ought to be paying $5,230 a year in road use taxes trespassing on my property and the property of every other property owner that he's driving his truck down. So the state comes in here and they says, well, now look, boys and girls, wouldn't you like to have us come in here and take over this road and pave it for you and operate it? And everybody said, yeah, we'd like you to do that. And the state came in, took over all the roads and bridges, and they build all that stuff and that infrastructure for us. And then if you want to drive down somebody else's road, you got to have a license to do that. See how simple that is? All right, so it's a criminal activity. I didn't make it that way. I'm just a reporter, just reporting it to you. Now, it's a permission to do some act or series of acts on the land of the licensor. So you need this permission. So the state came in here and gave you permission to do this act on my land, drive your car across my property, without having any permanent interest in it. You people don't have any permanent interest in my road out here, on my land out here that they built that road across. Now, it's an authority to do a particular act or series of acts on another's land without possessing any estate therein. Ah, see? You want to perform an act on my land without possessing any estate therein. And so you do. And that's why you're licensed to drive your car across my land. It's an executed license, or an executed license exists when the licensed act has been done. It's an executory. It's an executory license. Exists where the licensed act has not been performed. An express license is one which is granted in direct terms. An implied license is one which is presumed to have been given from the acts of the party authorized to give it. See that implied license? Do you remember those implied contracts from Kessler on contracts? Implied. The distinction between an easement and a license is often so metaphysical, subtle, and shadowy as to elude analysis. The adjudications upon this subject are so numerous and discordant that taken in an aggregate, they cannot be reconciled. but there are certain fundamental principles underlying most cases which enable courts to distinguish an easement from a license when construed in the light of surrounding circumstances. Now remember, a license can be revoked at any time. Now typically they got to have cause if you're going to revoke a license. Now the difference between a license, and then as you go through the definition here, it'll tell you as we progress on here that a license is not a contract. Just like Larry Beecraft yesterday said, you know, this Social Security is not a contract. Well, that's right, it's not an ordinary contract, it's an extraordinary contract. I'll agree with that. But it's a contract because it has all the elements. Now, when you go down to get a driver's license, you know, there's an offer by the state to give you a driver's license. There's an acceptance by you by signing up for it. There's consideration. You pay the fee. And then there's a time limit. It expires on your birthday 4 years from now. See how that goes? It's an offer with an acceptance over time with consideration. Furthermore, it has a penal clause in it. And if you violate the terms and conditions of the licensing agreement, which is obedience to the 2000 traffic laws of your state, we'll punish you. You can have fines or jail or both. And so they tell you as a matter of law, and that's what I just told you at the beginning of the program. I said, well, listen. There are no weapons of mass destruction. Or excuse me, the government came to us and said, Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. There are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. There are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Well, hell, just because they tell us there's weapons of mass destruction doesn't make it true, does it? Does government ever lie to you? Have you ever been lied to by government? I always tell people the government lies to you about 75% of the time, tell you the truth 25% of the time so they can keep you confused and disoriented 100% of the time. That's where that's at. Well, I'm not going to read all of the license story to you here. You know, there's 5 pages here on license here in Bouvier's Law Dictionary. Quite a little article. Just read it and then ask yourself, well, is this license an offer? Is there an acceptance over time with consideration? I think you'll come to the conclusion. It's a contract. It's an extraordinary contract. It's an implied contract. Comes under adhesions. All right, George, does that answer your question? I thought I'd tell you these Connolly stories over here. Now, listen, you know you're a poor guy living in your van. And you don't bother me any. If you want to live in your van, that's perfectly all right with me. That's the reason that we Americans used to take pride in America before we adopted the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto, became practicing communists. We used to take pride in giving people slack. You know, we let people live their lives the way they wanted to. Some people wanted to be farmers, and we said, well, that's crazy. But, you know, if they want to go out here and homestead and be farmers, that's fine. We'll let them go do that. And there were people that wanted to be industrial moguls, you know, like J.P. Morgan and Andrew Carnegie and guys like that. And we said, shucks, you know, if you guys want to be industrial moguls, well, that's okay. You know, robber barons, that's fine. Go ahead and do that. Today, though, in America, robber barons are looked upon as dog poop. Why we don't like successful people. We don't like rich people. Because it violates the tenets of from each according to his ability and to each according to his need. And we don't like poor people either. We don't like poor people living in their vans because it affects our property values in our neighborhoods. And we want you to go out there and be regimented and regulated like everybody else. And we've done that with our public schools. You know, we've turned our public schools into public institutions. We've institutionalized our children. Now our children go to these institutions. They're just like prisons. Public school, it works just like a prison. You have to go through a metal detector to see if you got any metal on you. And you got to be regimented. You got to be identified. You got to carry identification. You got to have a number. All of you school children out there, you got to have your number. In prison, we put it right on your clothes. In school, they got identification badges, and you wear this right up here on your left shoulder, you know. And you walk into the school, and you gotta have a biometric, you know, or you gotta have some kind of identification with a number on there, just like a prisoner in prison. And that's what institutionalization is all about. We institutionalize people who are mentally deficient, and we call those mental hospitals. And we institutionalize criminals, and we call those penitentiaries. And then we institutionalize our students, and we call those schools. Institutionalized people are unable to take care of themselves. They're unable to govern themselves. And that's why we put people that can't keep their hands off of your property in prison, because they steal. They can't control themselves, and so we institutionalize them. Mental people can't take care of themselves. They can't feed themselves, clothe themselves. They act funny. They act bizarre. They sleep in their vans and crazy things like that. And then we declare these people to be mentally incompetent, and we institutionalize them. We put them in hospitals. And when you're a young person and you're unable to educate yourself, or your parents are unable to educate you, then we put you in an educational institution. And of course, you people get violent and shoot people and do crazy things in these institutions. And of course, that's understandable, isn't it? Institutionalized people are irrational. Institutionalized people are undependable. People that are in institutions are people that are the dregs of society, unable to govern themselves. And so that's why we institutionalize them, so we can tell them when to get up in the morning, when to go to bed at night, and what to do in between. It's the opposite to the kind of freedoms that we Americans were used to under our Constitution before we were contracted or subscripted into these institutional formats. Driver's license, that's an institution. And building permits, that's institutionalized housing. And we're used to it. I mean, don't think that slavery is all bad. Remember that old story of Toby? You know, this guy was a black fella, and he wanted to trace his roots, and so he wrote a book called Roots. And they went back into the old slave process, you know, and he had a descendant by the name of Chicken George, I think it was, who actually bought his freedom. He was a black free man in America in 1828. Isn't that just special? Sure. That was a black man that said, well, I think I can assume the role in society that the Constitution requires. I think I can be a free man, pay my bills, and stay out of the institutions. And so he did. It was a wild new concept, you know, for blacks back in 1828, but the blacks today have reverted back to where they were back in slave times. Now they've got to have permits, and they've got to have institutions to govern them, tell them when to get up in the morning, when to go to bed at night. It's not just the blacks, now it's the whites and everybody else at the same time, isn't it? Except for this guy here says, hey, I think I can take care of myself in my own van. And we say, no, we can't have that. We got to have this guy institutionalized like everybody else. All right, we're about out of time, so we're going to have to leave it right there. So we'll come back tomorrow night, and we'll finish this program up, and I'll show you what the Bible has to say about this thing of contracts. And we'll take a little look here at George Mercier on contracts and how that process works. Keep in mind that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, just go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Remember to order yours. Just go to the call direct. You can go direct 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, we're out of time. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.